Welcome to A Handful of Dust. This is a podcast about Sandman by Neil Gaiman and all its forms, both comic and now TV show. I'm Jenny.
And I'm Eamon. And it's time to sort of wrap up the first season of The Sandman on Netflix.
Yep.
We've got all the way up to the last episode, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Or we thought it was the last episode. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Lost Hearts, the last episode, and we're going to talk about the bonus episode 11 with its two-part story.
Yep.
As well. And then we've got some other thoughts about the whole season, about the future to get to as well. So last time we dealt with the majority of the Doll's House storyline and some uneven bits possibly in the journey. And some bits which made us smile for the wrong reasons, perhaps. Then we get to the last episode, and it's all got to sort of come together.
Yeah.
And if I can recap what I can remember from this episode, we've got to have some more exposition in the dreaming to explain what's going on.
Yeah.
We've got to have Rose Walker and Jed returning to Cape Kennedy.
Yeah.
We've got to have the dream where everything starts to get pulled into the vortex. So then we're going to see the other housemates' dreams before Unity Kincaid. In this version, Unity Kincaid travels to Lucienne's library.
Yeah.
And discovers something about herself. And then we're going to get the final confrontation between Rose Walker and Morpheus. Gilbert intercedes as Fiddler's Green and then becomes Fiddler's Green again. And then finally Unity Kincaid will turn up. And then at the end of it all, we'll get a little bit of wrapping up and everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reminder. Okay.
That's for me, who's been 2 weeks since I've seen this episode.
So, having said all that, what did you think?
I like this episode. I think it matches the tone of the comic book quite well. That sort of nice moment between Unity and Rose sort of one-upping dream and like thinking, doing something beyond what Dream was thinking. And yeah, I think it wraps up nicely. I think it maybe there was a lot of pressure to wrap up the first season and perhaps leave us wanting more. And it's interesting that they then followed it up with a bonus episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think, as we've talked about, these early volumes of The Sandman, we know as readers there's good stuff coming, but as television watchers you might be like, what is this show? You know. So I think there's a lot of responsibility on that final episode to be like, please keep watching, there's going to be more interesting things. And I think it delivered quite well.
Good. Okay. I mean, obviously we've got Rose and Jed back at... They both get back to Florida, don't they? They both get back to Hal's house.
Yeah.
That's all good stuff. I mean, the dream vortex starts to happen. So if we talk about the dreaming part, where basically we get to see the housemates' dreams, don't we?
Yeah. Do we see them in one of the earlier episodes? We saw the first...
Hints
of them. I don't think we talked about them in the last episode, but they were good. And I think some of them... really strong. I liked is it Zelda's sentence one?
Yes.
I liked hers and Hal's drag dreams as well, being like that little bit of creepy drag was really good as well.
Mm. And in this one we really get into it, so we really see Barbie and Martin Tenbones.
Yeah.
Voiced by Lenny Henry. we really see Chantel and Zelda dreaming about one of them's in love with a sentence, and the other one's sort of replaying a sort of gothic childhood in a graveyard.
Yeah.
Obviously, we see Ken is trapped in a dream that he's done. He basically cheated on Barbie, I think.
Yeah, I feel like his dreams are a bit of a letdown. I feel like in the comic book, he has a very like quintessential yuppie dream, doesn't he, about numbers and
it's all money, sex and power, isn't
yeah
it?
Whereas in this it's like in the first one he's like naked, and then in this one he's like in the car with Cindy.
Yeah.
And it's just like, meh. It doesn't quite, I don't know.
And Rose Walker literally walks through the dreams, doesn't she? She walks through all of these dreams, including Hal's dream, where he does the sort of Mission Impossible pulling off your rubber face thing, and then goes another level down and pulls off his entire face, just like in the comic book.
Yeah.
So, yes, that was all. I liked all the dreaming coming together and just getting to see glimpses of these dreams, one of which we know will be very important if we get to season 3.
If our calculations are correct.
If our calculations are correct, yes. Who knows? It might be in season 2. So, yeah, that's all good stuff. I think we've got a bit more to and fro, and particularly with Unity Kincaid turning up in the dream in with Lucienne and reading the book of her existence.
Yeah.
And that gives, obviously, the big reveal, which is going to happen in the final confrontation. I suppose it takes us to Rose Walker versus Morpheus, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We've had these confrontations with Morpheus. We've had John Dee's confrontation with Morpheus. We've had the Corinthians confrontation. And now we get to the sort of confrontation with Rose.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Fry will pop up as Gilbert to offer Fiddler's Green instead of. And then, obviously, he transforms back into Fiddler's Green. The place. Yeah,
and we get the sort of idyllic rolling hills, which felt like very straight out of the comic book kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think in as a general point, I think the dreaming is becoming more of its, has like a more formed identity than it did at the beginning of the series. I think we talked about how it wasn't like weird enough. It wasn't like special enough. But now it does feel like there's a distinct difference between when we're in dreams and when we're in reality. I think they still could have pushed it further, but I think these scenes are like a key moment of like anything is possible in dreaming, and Rose sort of mastering it in a way.
Yeah. And I suppose that sort of fits with Morpheus rebuilding his kingdom as this series has gone on anyway.
Yeah.
We know he's been getting back to work and rebuilding the place, as it were. And presumably Merv Pumpkinhead has had quite a bit more pushing around his mop and his bucket to do. And the CGI on Merv has got slightly better. So that's all good. And then, of course, Unity Kincaid turns up to basically explain the plot to us.
Yeah.
Do the big reveal that she was meant to do the Dream Vortex. Also to drop the line about her wonderful man with golden eyes.
Yeah.
And dream, Morpheus goes,
uh-huh.
What?
Light bulb moment.
You what now? Yes.
Yeah.
Big light bulb moment. And then Rose reaches inside. I mean, I'm just like telling the plot now, but Rose reaches inside herself, pulls out the heart, gives it to Unity. Bubble.
Yeah.
The end of the sort of dream vortex.
Yeah.
Story. As you know, I was a bit sad that we didn't get Death turning up at Unity Kincaid's bedside when she died. And I know she doesn't in the comic book either, but I thought it was an opportunity to perhaps, you know, have her just turn up and say hi, Unity.
Because, yeah, and we will never turn down an opportunity to see Death in the comics or in the TV show, as it turns out.
Yes, exactly. I wanted another brief appearance. That would have been nice.
Yeah.
And then a bit like in the comic book, where you particularly saw it as Rose recovering from a trauma and then getting back with her life, we get a little bit of a wrap-up. Rose has written the book, or is writing her book, I think. And is she with Jed and Lita?
Yeah.
Hal's thinking of going back to New York and...
Yeah, there's a wrap-up. I don't think it's... I mean, obviously, the big change from the comic to the TV show is that Rose's mother has died in the TV show, whereas she is alive in the comic book. And so, in the comic book, you get the sense of like them recovering as a family and Rose recovering as an individual with this new like knowledge of the dreaming she's got. And I don't know if I quite bought that scene in this wrap-up as much as I did in the comic book.
Yeah.
It was maybe a bit too easy, and I don't know, the stuff with Lita Hall I just felt was clunky the whole way through and didn't, again, it was like, why are they friends again?
Oh yeah, of course, because Lita has the baby.
Lita has the baby now.
And everybody turns up at the hospital for the baby. Yes, Lita's
and it's
got
a
the
bit
baby.
Like,
yeah.
I don't know, baby in an elevator is like a TV show standby, you know, like, oh, just have a baby. That's the way we like create a dramatic arc here.
Mm.
I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how Lita's story plays out, because obviously it becomes quite crucial in the end of the season or the end of the comic books, and her experience of motherhood and things. I'm not convinced by the change in that storyline so much.
Okay. There was one change that I wanted to talk about, which was a change to a scene of Morpheus on the beach creating new dreams and nightmares.
Yeah.
And it features the reappearance or the remaking of Galt, the nightmare from earlier on in the TV series. And the reason I noted this, particularly on watching it the second time, was... So Galt's a sort of creation for the TV show to replace comic book characters.
Yeah.
And Galt was intended as a nightmare. And you really get, or I really got this strong impression that Galt doesn't want to be a nightmare. Galt wants to be a dream. And in fact, there's even a line that says, you know, even dreams can have dreams.
Yeah.
And Galt's dream is to be a dream. And Morpheus grants, you know, rather, he's done the previous sort of punishing by uncreating her.
Yeah. But and now, I think Lucien argues for Galt.
Lucien argues for Galt. Morpheus recreates Galt, but this time as a dream. And there's a real... And perhaps it's slightly heavy-handed, but there's a real transformational thing in that the dream Galt has got, like, butterfly wings.
Yeah.
There's a, you know, there's a real...
It's a pretty obvious, like, symbology going on, yeah.
Yeah. But I like that. I like the idea, firstly, that dreams can have their own dreams.
Yeah.
And secondly, that Morpheus this time says, listens to Lucien and says, okay, yeah, all right, we'll make Galt a dream.
I think... The relationship with Lucien in the comic books is good, but it's always sort of in the background. And I do like the way they're developing their character and the two relation and the like Dream and Lucien's relationship in the TV show to have a bit more like almost giving Lucien a bit more agency and a bit more like to do other than come in and like move the plot along. I do think that's like challenging Dream, and I think that will probably be crucial in the, you know, upcoming episodes when we sort of Dream faces more mistakes and more problems.
Okay. I want to ask you about Desire and the final sort of confrontation between Dream and Desire. Was there anything else from the sort of wrap-up of Lost, of, you know, the Doll's House storyline that you wanted to mention?
I mean, before we talk about Desire, we could briefly mention Despair, who turns up in one of the episodes...
Yes.
Earlier on, when we're about to go on, and I think I'm about to gush about like Desire's casting and general acting and costuming and that just being all spot on. I think Despair was a misstep, a pretty big one.
Mm.
In the comic book, although Despair is categorized as like a fat woman. That then they also have this like supernatural quality like Dream has of this like their complexion, but in Despair's context that's like very grey skin and the little tusk teeth.
Yes.
These sort of like non-human elements that I think make them work. The choice to cast just a fat actress, not saying that it's a bad thing, but it coats Despair as rather than this like universal, slightly otherworldly feeling, you know. I don't know, sort of personal interpretation of that character as like this weight of despair or this like inhuman, like almost animalistic, possibly like non, you know, like all those things that the comic book has, to then transpose that into a very gendered, very class. Fat phobic based character felt like a poor choice, I think. And I don't know if I'm articulating that entirely well, but it just felt like, oh, you're saying that Despair is just a fat woman, you know? And it's like, in the comic book, she's more than that. And like,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there is that otherworldly aspect in the comic book that Despair seems like some sort of supernatural creature rather than just a short, fat female person. Whereas in the casting, and my jury's out on her at the moment because we've seen so little of her.
Yeah.
But it just seemed like, you know, an actor with a certain physical appearance, and that was about it, and didn't really. I think.
Even to clothe her in like depression outfit, you know, beige cardigan, loose fitting clothes,
big funky pants, and
felt like a choice to like make her seem very mundane rather than, you know, there's something interesting about the fact that Despair doesn't wear clothes in the comic book, that it adds to their power in a way. They're a sort of confronting figure in the same, you know, they're meant to be the twin of Desire. They're meant to take up space in the same way that Desire does. And I think, I think it's a misstep. We'll see how the character goes on. I think we did get a bit of the like hook ring
self-harming
in the face again, but see, that reads differently, doesn't it? It does. It's like a human doing it to when it's doing like this grey person, like grey humanoid, you know? I think maybe that's going to be the tension in the show throughout, and we'll see as we meet other characters, other of the Endless portrayed, is that in the comic books it's very easy to do the shift between human, non-human elements, you know? Dream is able to be tall goth boy, but also like completely white, dark, shadowy eyes, big cloak that turns into night sky at the same time. In a comic book, that's very easy to do. In when you're dealing with a real human actor, that's going to get a bit more difficult, I think. And yeah,
I'm wondering what people who haven't got any experience with the comic books think about that character, because I think, you know, Dream is clearly Lord of the Dreams. Death clearly is Death. You know, she is there when you pass away and she guides you on to the next stage. This is where you get to find out. Desire, you know, even with not many appearances in the first season, but I think it's fairly clear what Desire, you know, what they represent. Despair, I'm not sure if people would have got that yet, but...
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's an aha moment that comes in the comic book when you meet Destiny, I think, and you sort of understand the naming convention. I think, you know, when does it trigger for you that they all begin with D, you know, like, but also a sense of like the hierarchy in the family, or like the aging, you know, what comes first, Destiny, then Death, and then we move on to the younger siblings.
Yeah.
Which maybe hasn't been, as they're being true to the comic book, those characters haven't been introduced yet, so we're not getting a sense of the family and their individual roles. But again, yeah, I think, you know, Despair never really gets a time to shine in the main run of the comic book. I think I can think of a few scenes that are very good in your favourite story, The Emperor of San Francisco.
Yeah, Emperor Norton First, yes.
I remember there being a very good scene with Despair in that issue. So that's maybe where we'll see if something can come more from it. But at the moment, yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll find out a bit more about Despair, hopefully, in the TV version. We do find out a bit about Desire, and we do get that final confrontation between Dream and Desire, because Dream has figured out what Desire has been up to in the background, you know, and Desire is the golden-eyed one.
Yeah.
And we also get the bit about, you know, I stand in my gallery and I hold your sigil, can I come and talk to you? And that it happens, and Dream turns up in the heart and meets Desire. What did you make of all that?
I think it was really good. I think one of the few moments in this where I felt like it's actually elevated and gone beyond the comic book. I think the setup of like Desire's palace being this like human body, because Desire lives under the skin and it's very fleshy, and I think that was really well done. The CGI was maybe a bit smooth, but I think it worked for this sort of like magical semi-real space. Is it Mason?
Mason Alexander Park.
The actor portraying Desire is really good. Like, looks just like the comic book, which is perfect. Has a good sort of winking smile. Almost breaks the fourth wall a couple of times. And the costuming is really good. I did a little squeal of delight when they showed up in the cat ear costume, because I remember that very...
Yes.
That is almost like comic book to screen perfect. That whole sequence, them like lounging on the their like couch in the little cat outfit with the like tail even CGI animated. I was like, that's such a nice choice to like bring that character to life in that way. Even though we've met them a couple of times before, I think that is just a very key moment, and I think, yeah, perfect comic to TV translation, and I think over maybe like beyond. It made me very hopeful for future, you know, like in the way that Despair made me a bit worried about how we were dealing with the different Endless. I think Desire's characterization and performance from Mason was like, yeah, perfect, pitch perfect, got it, understood the assignment perfectly, you know. And I'm excited to see how that develops and how their character plays out more.
In our last episode, I got a bit confused. I cut this bit out of the actual final podcast, but I got a bit confused because Mason had tweeted about their Hedwig buddy, John Cameron Mitchell, who plays Hal.
Yeah.
And you said, well, that can't be right because the movie was 25 years ago. But then we worked out afterwards that Mason played Hedwig on Broadway, I think, in a musical version.
And it's a nice little like connection there, I think, bringing the two actors together, even though they're not together and on screen, you know.
Apparently Mason also got their audition by tweeting at Neil Gaiman in the first place.
I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And that show, like, I think that is because I hope that they're a fan of the comic book, and maybe that's why they're doing such a good job.
I think they are, yes. Yeah. I think they're a fan of the comic book, they're a fan of the character.
I hope that casting process continues. Anyone out there who thinks that they are Delirium, please get in contact with Neil Gaiman, because I want that casting to be good. Like, that's what I'm thinking about when we're thinking about these two oppositional, like, Despair and Desire's casting. I really hope Delirium's casting falls on the Desire spectrum rather than this. I really want to see them get that character spot on, as everyone who's listened to the podcast knows that Delirium is my favourite character.
They've got to get Delirium right for you. They had to get Hobgoblin right for me, and they have to get Delirium right for you. And Emperor Norton the First, I'd also like to see.
I'm now trying to think, like, who would the fan cast be of, like, who Delirium. Are current actors that would pull off Delirium. I don't know. That will maybe be a follow-up episode, the fan cast of the next
season. Okay. So that wraps up the Doll's House storyline, and sort of we thought I'd finished the first season.
Yeah.
Where were you thinking about it at that stage?
Like I said, I think it was a good wrap-up of that season, but maybe there was still... I still felt a bit like it hadn't delivered what the comic book delivers in terms of, like, I want to see what's next, you know. Yeah. I want to see what the next... I was kind of a bit apprehensive because I felt like, oh, they've set up that the next season, the next thing we're getting is Seasons of Mist, and you know, as in the talked about in the podcast, not one of my favorite arcs in the comic book. So I was like, yeah, okay, I can see why, you know, we're gonna go from one arc to the next arc. But I was a bit like, well, we've had Hobgadlin mixed in, how are they going to mix in the individual stories and the one-off issues? And of course then we got the answer to that, which is bonus episodes.
Yes, we got bonus episode. We got the sudden unexpected drop of episode 11, a split into two parts. And before we knew about that, I was planning to ask you what stories from Dream Country were going to make it into the TV version. And I had assumed in my own mind that the Cats one...
Yeah.
And that the Facade one about Urania Blackwell, the Element Girl, mm-hmm. were not going to make it onto the screen.
Yeah.
I thought Calliope had to be there for plot purposes. Yeah. And I thought I still think A Midsummer Night's Dream will be hard to resist for a TV production company to say, oh, we get to do Fairy and Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah.
You know,
we get to fully Game of Thrones this situation.
Yes, exactly.
And they've already proved with the Hobgadlin story that they can do the period stuff really well.
Yeah. So they switched the order around. We got A Dream of a Thousand Cats animated.
Yes. A brilliant choice.
Yes. First of all, so that one, what did you make of that one?
I really enjoyed it. I think, again, to mimic exactly what I just said about Desire's scenes, they got comic book to TV perfectly. So maybe it didn't bring much new stuff for us as readers and fans of the comic book, but I think as an episode of TV, it was really great. And yeah, the animation style, I think, mimicked the artist's style really well in a, like, I'm glad that they did that and didn't try and, like, rejig it too much. Yeah, I think that was really good.
I mean, as listeners will tell, I spend a lot of time in the Sandman Twitterverse, and the artist, Kelly Jones, who I don't think is the sort of artist who gets many of their works adapted for screen, so excited about A Dream of a Thousand Cats. And you and I were looking at some of the images and comparing the screen to the, or the comic book to the screen, and saying, yep.
Yeah, it's exactly what it is. And I think, unlike other comic book TV shows, it was nice to see that Kelly Jones got a mention in the credits. You know, we've been watching things like Ms. Marvel and being like, well, where's the, like, original creators' names and the original artists' names here in the credits as thanks? Yeah. Obviously, that's how Marvel runs the show at the moment. But yeah, I think it was good to see that, like, that acknowledgement was there. And at all steps, actually, Neil Gaiman has been credited alongside artists, haven't they?
Like, yes,
for the show. Because
Sam Keith and Mike Dringenberg have been really credited a lot for the first season, because they were, you know, they're the first trade. The voice cast?
Pretty good. I think I found, actually, my favourite was the brief Joe Lycett.
Oh, right,
because that just was very unexpected. I feel like American listeners would be like, who is that?
Who's that English UK accents chap, yes.
UK listeners probably, I don't know, he hosted the Sewing Bee for a while. It was great. Just a good solid, recognisable English actor who I would never really expect to do voice work. So I'm kind of intrigued by that.
Can I dare to suggest that Neil Gaiman himself has got a good narrator voice, but not necessarily a good character voice?
Yeah, I think he just sounds like Neil Gaiman, doesn't he?
He does,
like,
yeah.
And, but, you know, maybe like Stephen Fry, it was a bit of an obvious choice, but yeah.
And there was a slightly, you get that feeling that slightly the friends of Neil Gaiman turned up to do their voice cast in this one, to do their little vocal turn, basically.
And I don't think it's 100, like, there's David Tennant at the beginning, isn't he? Plays the couple.
Yes. David Tennant is one of the human voices. Michael Sheen, who's the other half of Good Omens with Neil Gaiman, is another one of the human voices.
I feel like that was, I think that's the way to do it, right? I'd rather have that than I'd have Stephen Fry popping up.
Yeah.
Obviously cut in with other actors, you know. Let's keep the cameos at least one step removed so that, you know, your suspension of disbelief can keep, like, the live action rolling. But no, I thought that was a great opportunity. I think choosing to, I don't know, like, why I was like, obviously they'd animate it. Like, but I think just because we talked about it, we wouldn't think that they would even touch this.
No, I didn't think they would include it at all, but they did it.
Yeah.
They did it as animation. I think they did it almost to show the, you know, the non-comic book readers to say, look, this is what this show is going to be capable of. We can do an animated episode.
Yeah.
We can do a, you know, we'll be able to
dream
do some,
can be dream without Tom Sturridge's face.
Yeah, can be a cat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was a good choice.
I thought it was great. Really good fun, and does show what the show is going to be capable of.
I'm very excited about delirium sequences now. I'm thinking animated fishies.
We want to see those animated fish balloons and pigger balls and little chocolate humans.
Yeah.
Okay, so that takes us finally to Calliope, which we've now learned how to say.
We are getting lots of pronunciation help from the TV show. All of these are becoming canonised now, which is...
So the canonised version is Calliope. And the story, that a story that we found great difficulties with, of this writer, Richard Maddock, with writer's block, played by another Doctor Who alumnus Richard Arthur Darvill, Rory from Doctor Who, who basically, you know, as we know, comes into possession of or keeps in a locked room the Greek muse Calliope.
Yeah.
Now, this is a troubling episode because of...
Yeah, content warning for the next discussion.
Yes.
If you know the comic books, you know what's coming up. But again, this is a discussion of sexual abuse and it's not subtle.
No.
In the comic book. And it's, you know, they did a decent job in the TV show, but it's still very much the vibe.
Yes. Yeah. That you can woo a muse and gain her inspirational gifts, or you can basically... sexually.
I think Derek Jacobi says take them with force.
Take them with force. Yes. There you go. You can take them with force and still get the inspirational gifts, which of course is what Richard Madoc does in the comic book and does here on screen as well. They cut to black. Yes, he made an attempt at wooing her in a very sort of clumsy way by bringing her gifts at first, which is not in the comic book.
Yeah.
And then when he gets... his deadlines are pressing on him even further. You get him looking upstairs. We hear him banging on the door and calling her name, but we don't see anything.
Yeah.
And then the next thing, he's at his word, you know, at his computer, typing away furiously. And he has one very little neat scratch on his cheek,
mm-hmm.
and his shirt is open. And we know what's happened. And it's all very sort of, well, I mean, obviously they made a deliberate choice as to how they were going to do it. Did it give us as much disgust of the character as it did in the comic book?
I think it's a hard balance.
Yeah.
I think it did. I think we see the hypocrisy of the character who very quickly slips from like, oh, I'm definitely not going to do that to, oh, no, I totally am.
Yeah.
And I think we talked a bit about in the comic book episode, like, how this story is very much portraying the, like, hypocrisy and misogyny and abuses within creative fields. Like, they use it to take... like, Neil Gaiman uses it to dig a little bit at Hollywood in a very... what now is not a subtle reference, but at the time was probably a very subtle reference to everything with Harvey Weinstein and all of his associates. So they use this story... they do a similar thing in this storyline that, you know, we see the... yeah, the hypocrisy of Rick Madoc talking about his 50-50 gender split on his TV show and, yeah, all the while with this, like...
yeah, you've woman got a locked, woman locked, locked
in your attic.
Yeah.
Who has told you repeatedly that she is being kept and not, you know... so I think they use the storyline... maybe they got a little bit heavy-handed at the end with the, like, with some of it, but I think... yeah, we were never... I don't think we were going to avoid this in any way, and I think they made a good choice to keep us fully aware of what's happening from the very beginning, that, you know, Derek Jacobi has trapped her and abused her. I just keep saying Rory. Rick has bought her, traded her, and kept her, and although is given the solution to the problem, like, let me go, she repeatedly asks to be let go and is given more of a voice, I think, than she has in the comic books, he still acts in an abusive, horrible way.
Yes.
So I feel like they handled it as well as they could have done, you know, I think.
Calliope herself, in the comic book, a sort of blonde, waif-like depiction, here cast by as a Canadian Greek actress, yeah. Who I was just looking at, Melisande Mahout, who looks and sounds Greek,
yeah.
in her performance, which I thought, yeah, good, I understand that.
Yeah, that was a nice shift from a, like, westernised, like, Northern Europe idealised version of, like, a hot muse,
yeah.
to be like, oh no, what would a Greek woman actually look like, you yes. know?
And when the Three Fates turned up, they looked very sort of classical Greek. Robed, and they also, again, although it's from the comic book, but they really sort of, they delivered the, you know, you had a relationship with Morpheus and you had his child.
Yeah,
you
know, and we get the story.
Yeah, and we all go, oh, And you know, and he was the one who was torn apart because of it. He had a beautiful voice, and everybody goes, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So I liked all that. I thought that worked very well. The casting of the Fates is great. Their performances are great. Of course, there's a couple of things I wanted to ask you about. One was the horror depictions, and the other was, of course, the relationship between Calliope and Morpheus.
Yeah.
Perhaps if we come to that bit last, there's the moment where Morpheus turns up and says, release her.
Mm-hmm.
And Rick Maddox says, no. And therefore, you know, I won't have any. And he says, I think, you know, where will I get my ideas from? And Morpheus says, ideas, very well, yeah. You know. And in the comic book, I noticed it is only a page or two. It happens very quickly, yeah. Where he is literally, his mind is drowning in a sea of ideas. And it happened quite quickly on screen. And actually, I wanted that to be slightly, I personally would have elongated that slightly and made the horror of what he does on the staircase with his.
Yeah, I think the gap between Morpheus being like, if it's ideas you want, and then the like breakdown at the end of the lecture, I felt like it almost played as comedy a bit, and then the horror wasn't quite as shocking as enough, you know? Mm. Yeah, the episode had a weird tone to it because obviously they set it up like Rick's house is this like really dark, foreboding space, which doesn't make any sense at all for a character who like had one hit novel and is now like a professor to have afforded this like ridiculously beautiful, ornate house in what looks like central London.
Yes.
You know, like,
yes.
You know, you could buy that maybe his success, he bought a house with his first novel's work, but like it just didn't quite fit his character, I felt.
Writers in TV and movies do seem to do extremely well.
Yeah.
They're extremely rich and famous, and they have fabulous houses.
Yeah, impeccable interior design skills.
Yes, they do, yeah.
And like, yeah, doing all that from a little MacBook on a very ornate desk, it just seems a little bit unlikely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't really buy any of the like lecture hall stuff. I think, what was is the show with Sandra Oh?
Oh, what? Killing Eve? Or?
No, the one where she plays like an English professor.
Oh, yes.
We get a brief. One of the Duplasses plays like a writer who had one great novel and who's now like stuck in this dead end professorship. And I was like, I think they could have leaned a bit more. Like, he's not having a great time. He's sort of set up a bit as like, you know, he's still getting ego bumps from his students. And I think they should have set it up a bit more of like, no, this guy is like, struggling and not as cool as he was 10 years ago. And I think they could have played with that a little bit more.
I think there were deliberately gaps in the audience of the first lecture, but I think they could actually have done that more. They could have actually had practically nobody going to his lectures until he becomes.
Yeah, just the whole setup. Like, the lecture was like a little like love-in of people asking questions. You know, it's not. We all know that's not what lectures are.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that. Yeah, like you said, when he gets his success, there's quite a bit of like. Just. It worked, but it was a bit silly. It felt a bit silly, you know, and I think maybe that detracted from the horror of it too. It was almost like what would you say, like the irony of the situation of him being like, people of colour, women on my, you know, on my team, and then like the irony of her upstairs, not the horror of her upstairs, you know. Yeah. I think that could have played out a little bit more. Yeah, and like you said, the final scenes of his punishment, his sort of like twisted curse, his wish that becomes a curse kind of thing, could have played out a little bit more horrific, I think.
Okay. In the comic book version, Morpheus himself is in full Kelly Jones depiction of this tall, thin, white shock of Robert Smith black hair, and he's very cold towards Calliope.
Yeah.
He's doing what he's doing, but he's extremely severe and cold with her.
Yeah.
Again, in this version, Morpheus, as played by Tom Sturridge, gets more to do.
Mm-hmm.
We get much more the idea that these two were a couple and actually still have feelings for each other, but it's complicated.
Yeah.
in the comic book, she says, can I come and visit you in the dream? And he just says, no.
Yeah.
That would not be a good idea. Whereas in this version, he says, maybe.
Not yet.
Just yet. Yeah. And you get this, you know. So I thought all that, I actually preferred all that stuff. I thought that worked good, well.
I think so. I mean, obviously, we're going to get, in the TV show, we're going to have some of Dream's girlfriends. And yes. Some of the, all the problems that come with Dream's girlfriends. So it was interesting to see them go for a softer approach here. And I think that came from the casting of Calliope as well, that like she is a more rounded character, she has agency. It's a sense of like her discussion with the Fates, and then her decision to call for Morpheus comes from a place of control over her own life, you know, and her own destiny, rather than begging for help, which sometimes I think in the comic book it can be read as
very
like,
much begging for help,
yeah,
literally
isn't it? Like
straight down on sort of hands and knees,
please
begging for
save
help.
me, whereas this is like, I need to get out. You're the person who can help me get out.
Yes.
Which is a very different scenario. And then, of course, we get this storyline of her being like, well, now I'm going to change shit because this can't happen to anyone else ever again. Which I felt was... I understand why they did it. And like like I said, it's a little bit heavy-handed of like... we'll get people to realise this is wrong. I think it could have been written a little bit neater and a little bit more like... we'll get people to listen, you know, like, let's not pretend that people haven't ever spoken out before, you know, 2022 Calliope is released, you know, like, let's give, in general, the population a bit more credit and say, actually, what we needed was listening and law changes, which I think she does mention.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think her character helps that scene feel more grounded and more real, and, like, she brings the softness out of Dream and Tom Sturridge's performance, rather than it being like straight from the comic book, you know. It's her, yeah. It's the way they've rounded out her character that makes that relationship believable in a way that it isn't really in the comic books.
Talking of her agency, the way she manipulates Rick Maddock to tear up the note with Morpheus's name on it and throw it on the fire, and we see the smoke going out of the chimney pot. And it sort of makes me think that Calliope may have inspired Mary Poppins.
We did joke, like, oh, Mary Poppins is going to come save her.
You know, there's obviously Mary Poppins is one of the texts referred to by the Sandman. So, yeah, that seems fitting. But, yes, they give her agency this time. Or, she, you know, she actually does something rather than just prostrating herself and just beg for him to appear. This time she actually... she uses Rick Maddock. I thought it was reasonably clear to me that that's what she wanted him to do.
Yeah.
He's tear it up, throw it on the fire, and yeah.
Yeah, like...
okay, because that's how you summon Morpheus, apparently, and Mary Poppins.
I think that might have hit a bit harder if we'd had the moment in the Doll's House where... because in the comic book, when Gilbert leaves, he leaves Rose a piece of paper with Morpheus and says, yes, if you need help, say this name out loud.
Yeah.
We don't get that in the Doll's House, so maybe if we had that connection of like, oh, the name is what's powerful here, would have hit a little harder. But I think it still worked. I just think that I was a bit, you know, as we talked about in the Doll's House, a bit disappointed by that whole handling of the Gilbert Corinthian situation,
because Stephen Fry just buggered off.
He just buggered off, and the Corinthian is the one that saves Rose when it should be Dream.
The power of the name.
So I just think it would have been a nice to have that callback, but it still worked. And like I said, Calliope as a story is going to become essential. You know, I can't say that I didn't want to see it, because it means that Brief Lives, it gives us the setup for Brief Lives coming on later on. And yeah.
Okay. The casting of Destruction is going to be also key as well.
Yes. But I think that one will be easier, because I feel like there's lots of people who could do... yeah. We're going to do a fan cast episode, I think. It's a bit late now, we've had the first season, but...
okay. So that was Calliope. That was the end of the two-part episode 11. And I would rather watch Calliope on screen than I would read the comic again. I love Kelly Jones' visuals, but I would rather watch the TV version, which I think worked better for me.
Yeah.
And I thought everybody in it was great. You know, all the cast in this were great. Derek Jacobi is actually quite good at being evil and repulsive.
Yeah.
you know, famously his 2 minutes as Doctor Who's Master were still probably one of my favourite incarnations of the Master. Derek Jacobi's just great. So yeah, I really enjoyed this. We were surprised by this episode. We got the Dream of a Thousand Cats, which was wonderful. We got Calliope, which was challenging, but I thought was well done. I liked the execution. And that's it. That's all we've got for now.
Yeah.
As we record, we still don't know about second season. For all the reasons that we've discussed so far. But we really, really, really want it.
I think I would say after... when The Doll's House wrapped up, I was a bit like, yeah, that was good. If there's another season, I'll probably watch it. It'll be Seasons of Mist. It will be good. I'll watch it. After those two, after The Dream of a Thousand Cats and Calliope, I was like, Calliope. I was like, oh no, now I'm excited again. Like, now I'm actually... And maybe it's this mirror is the same when I'm reading the comic book as well, as being like, that point is when... I mean, it's not to say the fun kicks in, but the, like... creativity kicks in and the wildness and the possibility there kicks in, and I think that has got me excited. Like I said, like, I'm excited to see if they do animation for Delirium. Desire's casting has made me excited about how they'll cast Delirium, like A Game of You. I think we got hints of how they're going to do Martin Tenbones and like that stuff, I think. But really having like a chance to see how they do the individual issues, and that they are going to do the individual issues, even if they're woven in throughout a bigger story arc. I think that made me really excited about the possibilities.
We haven't mentioned that at the end of The Doll's House, or the end of The Lost Tarts, episode 10, we get a teaser of Gwendolyn Christie as Lucifer saying, we're going to destroy Morpheus, setting up season two, as we thought, Season of the Mists, a Season of the Mists. So obviously they really set that up. That's what's coming. That's very Game of Thrones, I'm going to destroy Morpheus, and the Dukes of Hell are all sort of lining up to support.
We saw
Azazel with Roger Adams' voice,
which again, one of those things that makes UK people giggle, and maybe American people be like, yeah, it's just an English voice. But it's like known for comedic acting, and so it's a bit of a strange choice there. But the animation there of that like vortex with multiple teeth, that's straight out of the comic book, and it worked really well and was what I was hoping to see earlier. When we had the hell scenes, that wild stuff, I think. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. So yes, again, little pieces that actually do make me excited about what's coming for future volumes.
At the end of the first episode, they did that coming up this season on The Sandman, where they did all the explosions and stuff. And
Matthew the Raven saying, fuck.
Yes, we're going to hell. Fuck, okay, we're going to hell. And I think the two-part episode 11 really sort of worked at saying... this is the sort of stuff we can do in The Sandman.
Yeah.
We can do these little standalone stories where he's a background character, almost, this is what we can get. So I hope it works. I hope we do get those. And I hope, or let's put it another way, I think they're going to do a Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah.
I'd be surprised if they do Facade other than a character that Death encounters just incidentally...
I mean, it would be interesting to see how they handle death in general, because obviously we know that there's a lot of good death material that doesn't exist in the main run.
Yeah.
That they're not going to pass up that opportunity, surely. So, maybe there'll be bonus episodes again that are like death storylines. Me and my friend were talking about how one of our favourite spin-offs is the Little Endless stories that Jill Thompson wrote, and how we would love a Muppet Babies style animated series of that.
You see, now they've done the animated cats, you could see them doing that within an episode and have it work.
Yeah, I mean, the first time they appear is in one of the one-shots, right? Because Cain and Abel
are telling stories. It's in the Fables and Reflections collection it's one story out of three that are told in that issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
A single issue.
So that's the first time we see them. So I think
could work.
It could work as a little aside, but I would love a spin-off. get Jill Thompson back to write it.
Do you think in A Season of Mist we'll see the dead boy detectives?
I'd like to, yes. Again, we're like a lot of these early stories, there's a lot of tough story matter to deal with, but I think that would be a fun episode in itself.
In the Distant Mirrors little mini run of standalone stories, we've got the Roman one, which I'm not sure we particularly want to see again. We've got Lady Joanna Constantine retrieving the head, which I'm sure...
we'll probably wrap up into, like they did with the Hobgadlin, they'll probably put it
got to see
at the beginning of Brief Lives or something.
Yeah, we've got to see that one, because they want to bring back Jenna Cole as Lady Joanna Constantine, and they've got to have that story. We've also got, obviously, 3 Octobers and a January, the Emperor Norton story, which, as you know, I am itching for them to do.
I mean, they did such a good job with the Hobgadlin story that I can't see them messing that up. I think that would be good casting if they get it. And then
okay, and then obviously we would be on after that to A Game of You. Okay, so there we have The Sandman on Netflix. Season 1 is complete.
Yep, unless they drop another bonus episode.
Who knows, and who knows what scenes they have already filmed for series 5. You had some ideas about...
I thought it might be the Fates.
Right.
Because having cast those three, their scenes always are very intercut. You know, we don't necessarily need to see them in the same room as people. But I guess it could be Lita as well. It could be some of her scenes. But I was just thinking about scenes you would just do if you had the people in a studio and didn't have to do costuming and sets and stuff that would come with a full season of TV. I thought the Fates. That was my theory.
Okay.
I don't know what your theories were.
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I would... You see, actors like Derek Jacobi and Charles Dance, I don't think they need them again at the moment, or at least they don't need them in terms of the comic book version. Whether they need them for what they intend to do with Series 5 for flashbacks or whatever, I don't know. Possibly. Don't know. I just thought it was interesting that they, you know, Neil Gaiman has said they've specifically filmed some scenes which they hope to use in Series 5. Let's have Series 2 first of all, with Netflix. And let's get A Season of Mist and some of those other standalone stories that show the capacity that, you know, show what Sandman can do.
Yeah. Maybe some new stuff.
Maybe, yes. Surprise us.
Yeah. That would be interesting.
Yeah. Okay, we're coming up. This one's going to be a longer episode. We're getting near to the end of an hour. Anything else you wanted to say before we wrap up?
Nope, I think I'm all out of thoughts.
Okay, we may be back. We may have more episodes. We may get casting news about some of our key characters that we want to see on screen. We might come back and discuss those. We still have a bunch of other books that we may come back and talk about at some point. We'll see.
Yeah.
I'd like to say thank you to everybody who's been in touch about our return and is listening again. It's very nice to know that people are listening and have got their own comments and views about Sandman on Netflix. Great stuff.
Yeah, it's nice to see that some people are coming to the TV show having not read the comic book.
Yeah.
And then coming to our podcast having not read the comic book. I feel like that's really interesting, and I'm glad that that is happening.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I've been Eamon.
And I've been Jenny.
And thank you for listening to A Handful of Dust.
Bye.